conclusion that you would come by would be that between now and December 31st would be an excellent time to blow heavy contract to both the Heritage Foundation and Philadelphia Society. You know, it's interesting when you talk about taxation, because one of the nefarious and frightening things of government was covered so eloquently by Milton Friedman and with some help from Rose back in 1963 with their wonderful volume, Capitalism and Freedom, in which they essentially pointed out, and to my knowledge has never been refuted to any degree, that all government activities and departments, starting with the Interstate Commerce Commission, Department of Agriculture, and so forth, from that point on in the late 1800s, 1884, I believe, served to accomplish precisely the opposite of their intentions. And a number of years ago in the late 60s, I was doing some research in preparation for a book in a particularly snowy winter, and I managed to get from the government printing office all of the testimony that took place in 1913 at the time they were passing the income tax amendment to the Constitution, the 16th Amendment, which has no limit on it. And if you go through the labor of going through that large stack of testimony, you come to the conclusion at the end very quickly that there is no way that that amendment could even have approached passage, except that everyone on both sides of the hall fully agreed it could never possibly exceed 2.5%. So it shows you the kind of danger we're in. Our next bringer of wisdom is Sally Pipes. Sally Pipes is assistant director of the Vancouver-based Fraser Institute, a past president of the Association of Professional Economists of British Columbia. She is the immediate past president of the Canadian Association for Business Economics. In 1982, the BC Ministry of Consumer and Corporate Affairs appointed her a director of the Credit Union Deposit Corporation of British Columbia. She served as treasurer of the Association of Book Publishers in British Columbia for three consecutive years, and in 1985 she was reappointed further. In 1985, she was also nominated for a YWCA Women of Distinction Award in Business and Professions. In June 84, Sally was awarded by the Association of Professional Economists of British Columbia the prestigious Crystal Ball Award for the best overall prediction of Canadian economic performance for 1983. We're looking forward to what you have in mind.
Thank you. I thought it was interesting last evening when I was listening to Tom Pangle talking about Americans conquering and Canadians coping. We've seen the Americans attempting to conquer the tax situation in the United States, and as Canadians we've been content to cope with the situation, although there are a few glimmers of hope on the horizon. Taxation, which is one of my areas of specialty, is one of the most pervasive aspects of our lives, yet many Canadians have a curious lack of interest. Now perhaps it is due to the fact, as Jean-Baptiste Colbert, Louis XIV's Minister of Finance, quipped, "The art of taxation consists in so plucking the goose as to obtain the most feathers with the least amount of hissing." Or perhaps it is the seeming inevitability of it all. None of us is under any illusion about the future direction of taxation in this country or in the United States. As we are all too aware, if our federal governments do not significantly reduce their deficits by cutting their spending, it is inevitable that each of us will be faced with much greater tax burdens in the future. The revised Canadian federal deficit, which just came out on Thursday of this week for the year ending March 31st, 1987, is in the neighborhood of $32 billion. We just, in March when the budget came out, were given a forecast of $29 billion. So it was an insightful comment by former Canadian Prime Minister Mackenzie King when he stated in 1931 that the promises of yesterday are the taxes of today. Well, we at the Fraser Institute can add, via the expedient of deficit finance, the expenditures of today are the taxes of tomorrow. Now, all of this foregoing is meant to imply that while I'm going to talk about tax burdens and by implication the need for removal, I am aware of the fact that the only real way to obtain tax abatement in this country is to ensure that government spending is reduced. When Finance Minister Michael Wilson gave his economic statement on Thursday evening, he talked about various things and said that, well, really, in these times, we're not going to increase taxes. We're also not going to reduce spending, but the deficit is going to go up by an estimated $3 billion. At the Fraser Institute, Michael Walker and I started getting an interest in the system of taxation.
How are you today? Really,
at that time, there was a hue and cry about the dramatic increase in inflation. Political pressure was intense and culminated in the federal government's introduction in October of 75 of a system of wage and price controls. But we discovered through our investigation that while the inflation rate had been increasing, there was a far more dramatic escalation in the rate of taxation in Canada. It came as a surprise to us that while the release of the CPI each month was followed by a tremendous outcry in Parliament and elsewhere, there was seldom a mention of the extent to which escalating taxation was imposing a burden on the average Canadian family. So in response to that, we undertook a series of studies, which we called our Tax Facts series. And just in June of this year, we released the fifth edition. We've had several improvements over the years, and finally in 1982, undertook a provincial comparison of tax burdens in Canada. Also in our 1982 study, we were able to get some material published by William Johnson and Edgar Browning on the U.S. situation. We were able to compare the two systems. And as it turns out, Canada has a much more progressive system of taxation than that which is in evidence in the United States. It really has turned out to be a bestseller for us, and it's been in recent years that the press has really picked up on the issue of our what we call our Tax Freedom Day. We developed a system where we developed an indicator called the Canadian Consumer Tax Index, and this has been very, very interesting to the media. So I'd like to turn some attention to the findings of our what we call our latest safari into the forbidding taxation jungle, and to discuss some of the results and trends, because I think to be able to put something on a level which relates to all of us as individual taxpayers, it is interesting. We have been able to identify certain stepping stones through the patches of quicksand, so even the most timid amongst us can stay. The analysis covers all three levels of government and deals with some 26 different tax categories, ranging from personal income tax, as we all know, which was a tax which was introduced in 1917 as a temporary war measure, and we've seen it increase rather than be removed following that war, to income tax, to property taxes, to federal excise taxes, etc. We've looked at 21 different sources of income, from wages and salaries to imputed rents. You may wonder why I said we analyzed 21 different sources of income. The reason is that in order to do a complete job of assessing the tax burden borne by Canadian families, we have to know precisely the sources of their income. For example, the owner of shares in a retirement fund bears corporate tax on the profits which would otherwise be earned by the shares in corporations held by the retirement fund. In order to distribute the burden of the tax, we have to first know the distribution of the corporate income which is taxed. Ultimately, the analysis distributes taxes accordingly as they burden capital income, wage and salary income, and a combination of both. Now, I mentioned to you a minute ago about the Consumer Tax Index, and the focal point of this analysis was the development of a measure of taxation called the Consumer Tax Index. All of us, of course, are familiar with the Consumer Price Index and how that's going up, and we wanted to be able to show Canadians how their tax burden had been increasing. The first year in the index is 1961, when the average Canadian family earned $5,000 and had a total tax bill of $1,675. Some 25 years later, that same Canadian family was earning $33,500 and faced a tax bill of almost $17,400. This shows that the total direct and indirect tax burden in Canada now stands at 51.9%, almost 52% of your total income is going to pay the various levels of government. This Consumer Tax Index has gone from a base of 100 up to an astounding 1,038, or an increase of 938% over the quarter of the century which we've analyzed. The index is meant to measure the tax burden of a family with unchanged relative position through time. It does not track the position of a given family through time. This is the subject of something of another study that we will be undertaking. Some of the questions the index will not answer. However, we do know that the average family in 1986 was headed by a younger person than it was in 1961, was more likely to own their own car, but less likely to own their own home, had fewer members than the average family did in 61, and was more likely to include two income earners. And I think this is very evident as we see fast food outlets and the number of people who are now going out to dinner is because we now have over 50% of families have two people working today. I mentioned to you also about Tax Freedom Day, and by translating the tax rate of the average family into the time worked, we were able to calculate Tax Freedom Day. And it's interesting that in 1961, Tax Freedom Day arrived on May the 2nd. Well, by 1986, that day had moved forward to July the 8th. So you can see, as when I mentioned the rate of 51.9%, average Canadian family, and that's the average family, is now working over 50% of the year to pay for government. Now there's another thing that we had to look at, which was deficits, because really deficits are a form of deferred taxation. If we add in the deficit, the federal deficit, into our tax calculation, that Tax Freedom Day moves forward till August the 4th. So, you know, we're really looking at a system which is quite depressing in this country. But one of the other points in looking at the burden, most people are aware of certain taxes they pay, income tax, property tax, and if you have in your state or in your province a retail sales tax. But not many people realize that there are 26 different categories of taxation, and that income tax only accounts in Canada in 1986 for 34% of your total tax burden. The other remaining amount, the 66%, or $11,000 of the 17.4, is actually these other hidden taxes, import duties, federal excise taxes, corporate profit taxes, etc. So income tax, although we think of it as being, you know, a major undertaking, is really only a third of our total tax bill in this country. A couple of examples of hidden taxes. If you were to take a liter of gasoline in British Columbia, or a $10 bottle of liquor, really, with a $10 bottle of liquor, only $1.68 of that amount goes to the distiller. $8.32 goes to various levels of government in the form of taxation. On a liter of gas, which is 49.9 cents, 51% of the pump price in BC also goes to various levels of government. Another interesting aspect of our look into taxation was when we compared the tax bill to the other necessities of life, food, shelter, and clothing. It was interesting that in 1961, the family paid more for food, shelter, and clothing combined than it did for taxes. This is completely reversed in 1986, when the tax bill amounts to more than food, shelter, and clothing expenditures combined. We saw the consumer tax index increase by 938%. Food expenditures, on the other hand, rose 295%. Shelter, 479%. Clothing, 302%. And overall prices by 313%. So in other words, there has been a systematic erosion of the relative spending power of the family and a corresponding expansion in the spending power of the state in this country. Voracious though it has been, the tax taste of government has been outstripped by their even more generous program taste. Now I'll just spend a couple of minutes talking about deficits, because since 1975 was the year in which deficit spending became a factor in Canada. That's when average family tax rates started to stabilize, and when Mike and I got interested in what was happening. It was then that the federal government began deficit spending by issuing bonds to finance their expenditures. That meant less reliance on tax revenue, and hence the possibility to allow average total tax rates to stabilize, having risen steadily in the previous 15 years. However, the slowdown in tax rates proved to be temporary. Despite high deficits, it also became necessary in 1978 to increase taxes as well to finance the programs which were being provided by Canadians. We heard that in the U.S. that defense spending accounts for 6 to 8% of GNP. Well, although we don't have a large defense budget, we do have a national Medicare system, we have a very comprehensive unemployment insurance scheme, we have a Canada pension plan, we have family allowance, we have many more social programs which are financed by government spending. In this study, we also looked at the provinces and found out which provinces were the most highly taxed. As an example, in Quebec, Quebecers faced the greatest income tax burden, the highest motor vehicle license fees, and things like that. So really, the people in Quebec are very highly taxed. Albertans pay the highest property taxes, and Ontario families pay the highest sales taxes. So really, the tax system in this country is all pervasive. We looked at another concept we called Robin Hood, because everybody had been saying, well, we need a just society, we need to equalize, we need to take from the rich and give to the poor. Well, this really is a difficult one, because when we looked at it, if we assumed all taxpayers that earned over $40,000 as being the so-called rich, and that all of their income above $40,000 would be taxed away, there really, in this country, there would only be around an $8 billion increase in federal revenue. If we assume that the government redistributed that to all the people earning less than $40,000, i.e. 14 million taxpayers, it would only give them an extra $582. So it's hardly justification for a draconian redistribution system in this country. And another point is that there are really very few rich people from which to get it. The bulk of the tax revenue is raised from the group of people which comprises the middle income class. Well, what about tax reform? Certainly in the U.S. we heard from Bruce Bartlett about the new what might happen in terms of the 28% top marginal rate. In Canada, we are hoping that now Finance Minister Wilson has called for a comprehensive review of the tax system, that something will happen in this country. We're slow to get off the mark, but at least we are getting off the mark. 3 years ago, we published a study called Focus on Flat Rate Tax Proposals, in which Michael Walker called for a dual flat rate system, which would be revenue neutral. We are most hopeful that something along this line will eventually come into Canada, but based on the past record of the Mulroney government and system of not following through with a lot of things once the analysis has been done, one is not sure. Anyways, I would like to thank you for this opportunity to talk about taxation in Canada, and I'll next week we'll be with Bill.
Business of, particularly in the case of taxation, trying to simplify complexities is sort of a hobby of mine. And I think it was a year ago, June, I was asked to testify in front of the Joint Economic Committee, which is a collection of IQs about the level of Iraq. And one of the questions that came up, and I was somewhat familiar with it, being involved with the productive sector of society, namely steel and machine tools in the United States. Why in the world, one of the astute congressmen asked if I could explain our reductions in productivity and our tremendous trade deficit, and I couldn't resist but to resort back to a very famous analogous story done by someone from the Foundation of Economic Education many years ago. And I suggested that if you were a student, sir, and had studied very hard for an examination and received a grade of 90, and another student, either due to laziness, inability, makes little difference, had received a grade of 60, between the two of you, you had produced 150 points of product or intellect. And when the professor suggested that he didn't think that system was fair, that you had an advantage for whatever reason. He was going to take 15 points from your grade and give it to the other students, so you would each have 75. You still would have produced 150 points of product. However, the question is, how hard would you study for the next examination? Obviously less, knowing you were going to lose a good deal. And of greater importance, what about the other student? He would study less, knowing that he was going to get something for nothing.